entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Sure enough is. Hi there. Welcome in. It's Sunday morning, May 26th, and this is the Best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble here with Kerry Haskell. Look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. Three good ones for you this morning. Actress and director and Maine native Katie Hazelton talks about her recent appearance on Veep and some exciting film projects that she's got in the works. Also, a lengthy conversation with actor and great friend of the show, William Sanderson, discussing his new memoir, Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. We get things underway, though, on a Sunday morning by bringing you our conversation with a guy who's been coming into homes for about a decade and a half now, is the host of Mythbusters, every single episode of that series. He's working on a brand new series, and Adam Savage also has got a new book out entitled Every Tool's a Hammer. We had a great time talking with Adam Savage about his book and his outlook on life. The book is so entertaining and interesting and useful, and I love a phrase early in the book you say, a healthy obsession is the gravity that binds us to the things we make.
Yeah, I was looking for some physics analogies that would help me think about and process and talk about making. And that one really hit me hard when I wrote it down, the idea of physics being a universal force that draws us towards making. But it's so true, and it's one of the things I'm finding is resonating with a lot of makers of every stripe when they read this.
And when it comes to making, often the hardest part is getting started, and that's one of the things that you focus on. You've got to jump into it and then worry about things as you go along.
Absolutely. There's a famous quote from Goethe where he says that boldness has genius, power, and magic in it, and then whatever you can think you want to begin, you should begin it today. And I've written this book as a permission slip for everyone who reads it to do exactly that, because there's never going to be a perfect workbench, a perfect outline for the thing you want to start writing. The trick is just to get started and try and build momentum towards the goal that you have.
I also was very excited to see a chapter on lists as a compulsive list maker. I love that you said that lists are not external to the creative process. Can you explain that?
Well, look, whether you're writing them down or you're keeping them in your head, everything that we decide to execute on includes a list. For me, I can keep a short list in my head, and I say short, I mean like four items or so. But as soon as it gets bigger than that, in order for me to understand what I'm working on, I need to physically write it down. And it has given me so much expansive ability to tackle larger and larger projects that I figured an entire chapter on list making and a second chapter on the checkboxes at the left side of every list item was totally necessary.
And I agree completely. I love that part of it. An important part of the book, too, is being able to step back and witness how you work.
Well, there's a Buddhist tenet about watching the watcher. And that ability to watch yourself while you work, to notice your proclivities, one, to improve yourself, to improve your working process, to see the obstacles you hit on a regular basis. But two, to refine your working environment and your process to better suit you. So I'm always, when I'm in my shop working, I'm always taking note of the paths I trod to get tools that I want, of the ways in which how I place tools might help or hinder my working process. And that watching the watcher has really, really radically improved my ability to adjust my workspace to fit my needs.
Now, another thing that you've talked about in the book a lot is the usefulness of deadlines in sort of forcing the creative process for you. And even those self-imposed deadlines, is that become easier for you to create those the deadlines for yourself? Or is that still something you work on?
No. So I've been lucky enough to do what I do both professionally and personally, and have a lot of crossover in the types of projects I do in both of those realms. But a lot of people might have a job that's not necessarily feeding them creatively, but they go and they want to do things at home. They want to write or make clothes or play the guitar or write a song. And when you don't have a parameter on the creation that you're doing, it can just keep on extending out into the distance. And I've had projects that took me more than a decade and a half to finish because I didn't have a point at which I needed them finished by. And as long as I don't have that, I just sit there belaboring every single decision. Well, could I get a little better part? Could I make this out of aluminum? So what, you know, I start obsessing over every tiny detail. And when I impose, so one of those costumes was Kane's spacesuit from the movie Alien that I spent 14 years replicating. And finally, in 2014, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to say I have this ready for Comic-Con in July in San Diego, and that will get me to finish it. And another phrase I use in the book is deadlines lop branches off your decision tree. They force you to look at every step you're taking and ask, is this directed towards the essence of the project or is it ancillary? And that is a phenomenal question to keep asking yourself.
We're talking with Adam Savage on Downtown. His new book is called Every Tool's a Hammer. I love the section, I think it was with Andrew Stanton from Pixar, talking about the fact that you need to give yourself permission to make mistakes and what that can do for the culture.
Well, and not only Andy's, the interview I did with Andy is so wonderful because he's so inculcated in the ethos of the way that Pixar makes movies, in which he describes that they've institutionalized the process of changing the path of the film when it becomes necessary. So they write a movie at the beginning and they start making it, but the movie changes as they make it. They find new roads, new narrative lines, new characters, new ways of telling the story. And the trick is to follow that. Those aren't mistakes. That is the creative process taking you on a journey. We don't, when we set out to paint a painting or make a film, we conceive of an idea, but what we execute is never that idea. That's actually why we do it. If we knew what we were making, it wouldn't be interesting. The journey that we go on is the whole point. And the thing that's wonderful about listening to Andy talk about Pixar's process is that they've built that and baked that process right into the whole company. They'll look at a film 3/4 of the way done and realize radical changes are needed, and then they will implement those changes in service of the plot. And that's, if we called them something other than mistakes, it would be very good for us culturally because they're just iterations of creativity.
It, building on that, that the culture that you're talking about, one of the points you make in, early in the book is that humans are sort of built to collaborate, but that seems a little counter to the great American myth of the self-made man. Pixar has done a great job of encouraging that collaboration, but how do you see the other people getting past that?
I totally, you're absolutely right. America has the myth of the singular creator, of the genius at the center. And I have met some of these. I have been lucky enough to meet and spend time with a few of those. But I'm here to tell you that they're not one in a million. They're one in 100 million. These are very rare individuals. The rest of us, which is all of humanity, we have to collaborate. We work within a community. And I spent a long time in my late teens and my early 20s, kind of waiting to figure out how I might end up being a singular creator. And that's just a waste of freaking time and energy. I have learned over the years that I'm a born collaborator, and I love wheeling people into my projects. I love jumping into other people's projects.
Adam, you have opened up my eyes to glue. I know so much more about it now.
The entire chapter I wrote on glue was a really funny one because I went back and forth. I was like, am I going to talk about the physics of glue? I got to call a chemist. And then I thought, well, I don't know if I want to do a comprehensive thing on glue because there's some glues I positively hate. And that's when I realized, oh, you know what? I'm just going to tell you the 8 glues that I use and why. And if that helps, that's great. If it doesn't, you may disagree with some of the things I say. That's also great.
Yeah, I wish I'd read that about, you know, 20, 25 years ago. Stuff around my house would have been glued a lot better. Now, using the old cliche of being stranded on a desert island, if you're stranded on a desert island, what's the one glue you absolutely have to have?
Oh, that's a really good question. Okay, presuming that I could store it in perpetuity and that it would always be useful to me on a deserted island, it might be epoxy. For the specific reason that I could use it both to glue things together with great strength, but I could also use it along with the plant materials on the deserted island to make really rigid and rigid and larger structures using the epoxy.
I like that a lot. The last section of the book I found especially valuable as someone who's not particularly handy, but I think this can apply as much of the book can to everything we do in life, whatever we're building, and it's the idea of organization, see everything, reach everything.
Well, and again, this is a deeply personal book, and this is I'm explicating a process that has worked for me, and everybody has a different process, and some people may prefer to work out of a messier shop than I do, and that's totally valid. But for me, my shop being clean and the tools that I need being within my reach is really paramount for me. And the reason is because I like to work intuitively. So if I'm at the bench and I've got a thing that I'm sanding, but I need to cut something in it, I want a blade within arm's length of me. And that way I don't have to stop and think, okay, where are the blades? Let me go over to the drawer of the blades and get a blade and put it in a handle and put it in a thing and head back to my workbench. When I do that, I lose my momentum. So for me, all the creative stuff that I do has, again, this is another one of the physics analogies, has a momentum to it. And my goal is to keep that hoop spinning by hitting it with a stick. And for me, the stick is all of the tools I need within arm's reach without having to move anything out of the way. And I call that philosophy first order retrievability.
Along with the new book, you've got a new series that's coming soon. Can you tell us a little bit about Savage Builds?
Oh, yeah. It comes up on June 12th on the Science Channel right after BattleBots, one of my favorite shows in the world. And Savage Builds is an absurd engineering show with I have a different collaborator or collaborators in every single episode. Everyone from the queen of crappy robots, Simone Yatch, and my friend Laura Kampf, to Jet Propulsion Labs, Adam Steltzner. Gary Oldman shows up in one of the episodes. And in the very first episode, I, along with the Colorado School of Mines Engineering School, constructed a suit of Iron Man armor out of 3D printed titanium.
I love it. I can't wait.
Oh, my gosh. We had so much fun. We built a working ZF-1 from the Fifth Element. We replicated a World War II munition called a Panjandrum. Tori Belleche, my old co-host from Mythbusters, came on an episode, and we enjoyed a food fight with a minimum distance of 100 feet. Things got messy.
Well, you have inspired a couple of generations of people to go out there and get creative. How often do you run into someone in your travels who said, I know you told us not to try this at home, but I did it anyway.
That precise phrase gets spoken to me probably two or three times a day, every single day of my waking life. I am very gratified that I have not yet ever seen a news story in which someone harmed themselves doing something that we did on Mythbusters. So I like to believe that education was the only result, not injury.
The book is terrific. It's called Every Tool's a Hammer, Life is What You Make It. If you're listening to us for some reason out in the Seattle area, go see Adam tonight at 7 o'clock at Lake Forest Park. Adam, it's been a real treat. Thank you so much for joining us. We wish you great success with the book and with the new show as well.
Thank you so much. You guys have a wonderful day.
That's Adam Savage here on the Best of Downtown on a Sunday morning. Every interview we have is a lot of fun, some more so than others. We're both Carrie, big fans of Mythbusters and Adam and Jamie and their work.
Yeah, Mythbusters was one of those shows that I just got absolutely hooked on and would watch. I had episodes that I'd watch over and over, you know, certain myths, the rocket car series of experiments they did were, I just loved those ones especially.
Yeah, the book is a really fun read as well. Yeah, he was a great guy, Adam Savage, here on The Best of Downtown. When we come back, actor-director, that is, Katie Asselton, here on Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Spring is here, and that means biking season. And the experts at Slipping Gears have just what you need. They're the area's premier full-service bike shop, located at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. With outstanding service and a huge stock, they've got the parts, accessories, and the expert advice you need, as well as the fastest repairs around and a great selection of new bikes. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, Saturdays, 9 to 5, and you can shop online anytime at slippinggears.com. Slipping Gears, 753 Stillwater Avenue, Bangor.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Pretty sure this should be considered a public service announcement. So in advance, you're welcome. I just went to the Ground Round in Bangor and had the most amazing food from their special menu. First, I got the Reuben Egg Rolls, which is all the flavors of the classic Reuben sandwich wrapped in a crispy egg roll and served with savory garlic smoky paprika sauce that has this slight kick. It's so good. To go with it, I ordered the Memphis fries, French fries loaded with pulled pork, drizzled with barbecue sauce, topped with chopped pickles and diced onions. If your mouth is watering right now, head to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor, groundround.com.
Success. For some, it's the result of luck. For the Maine Black Bears, it's the result of planning, determination, and hard work. Success may have brought you financial rewards, and now in many ways, life isn't simpler, it's more complex. Your choices impact more people and can have longer lasting effects than ever before. At ClearPoint Financial, we understand your challenges. We can help navigate today's changing financial landscape and help you pursue your financial goals. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. See what ClearPoint Financial can do for you. Call us today at 307-7718.
Back on the Best of Downtown, our next guest appeared for several seasons in the terrific show The League. She's been a part of Legion on Fox and recently did a great guest appearance on HBO's Veep. We had a chance to catch up with a great friend of the show, Maine native actor-director Katie Azelton. Hey, it was great to see you recently on Veep. How did that appearance come to pass? It was very funny, as always.
Wasn't that so fun? Well, the reality is when Veep calls, you take that call and say yes. And I was just so excited to have an opportunity to work with those guys before the show ended. It's their final season, so I would have done craft service for them if I could have. They didn't offer. Instead, they offered me a small role, which I was also happy to take.
Yeah, we had Anna Klumsky on last week and Tim Simons, who's, of course, also from Maine. And, I love the series, but it was...
You know that I have run into Tim on our flights home for the holidays?
Oh, really?
Yeah, we tend to travel back to Maine together.
Well, he's a good guy, and he's got a new development deal for a series with HBO, too. So good stuff. We'd like to see those Maine people succeed.
I know. Me, too.
And love the episode that you did for Mark and Jay's show, Room 104. That was terrific.
What a dream. I loved that experience so much. It's so interesting. Room 104 is such a cool show in that it's an anthology series. So every episode is its own sort of standalone story, all taking place in the same hotel room. And so to get to play a character who is or is not artificial intelligence and to play with that for 25 minutes was so insane and so fun. We only had 2 days to shoot it. It was wild. A lot of words.
Well, that was terrific.
But I loved it.
Now, loved your work on Legion. Season 3 is coming up. Will your character be back?
You know, in a sort of strange way, yes, but in a general way of speaking, no. In that, I technically am not there, but Aubrey's character Lenny still sort of has my body.
Okay.
So there's pieces of Amy there. Katie Azleton is not there.
Well, a little bit is better than nothing at all.
Sure, I like to be a nice memory.
We're talking with Katie Azleton here on Downtown. Somebody asked you the other day on social media, and I thought it was a great question. Why don't you do more episodic TV guest shots on TV? Because every time you show up, it's great. I loved your work on Curb Your Enthusiasm. What's wrong with these people in Hollywood?
Why don't I do more television? I love that he asked, as if it was a choice of mine.
Right, right, yes.
I don't want to do more television. The reality is I would love to do all of the television. I do feel insanely lucky that I've gotten to be a part of, like, these very iconic shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Office and Veep, and I've gotten to work with incredible actors. But yes, would I like to be on a more regular show more regularly? Yeah, let's work on that.
I know. We'll get those people to pay attention, smarten up a little bit.
Come on.
You've got a couple of movies.
It's like, you know, I remember my parents would be like, Katie, I just don't understand why you're not on a commercial for, you know, AT&T. I'd be like, yeah, I don't get it either. I don't know. I would love to. That sounds great.
Let's talk about a couple of movies that you've worked on that both look terrific, starting with one that will be released in a couple of weeks, The Tomorrow Man, working with some pretty talented folks, John Lithgow and Blythe Danner.
Yeah, this was it's a small independent. It premiered at Sundance this year. And again, I just am so, like, I'm getting these crazy opportunities to work with, like, the most iconic actors, you know? And John Lithgow and Blythe Danner are just maybe the loveliest. I'd love to speak about the movie. I haven't seen it, but it was a really interesting script. And the director was a first-time director, but he was a cinematographer for David Fincher for a while. Wow. So he's got really beautiful vision, so I can imagine it's going to look really good.
And then also another movie that's in post-production right now, The Devil Has a Name, directed by Edward James Olmos, Martin Sheen, David Strathairn.
Getting all these beautiful, amazing actors in the last chapters, right?
Like, wow.
But it really was, like, crazy. I mean, Martin Sheen. Yeah. I had to, like, have courtroom battles with Martin Sheen.
How amazing is that? That's fantastic.
It's epic. It's like real dream come true stuff.
Any idea when that one will be coming out?
I am assuming in the next year or so. I'm not quite sure what their plans are. I know that I just did ADR like two or 3 months ago, so that tracking wise means maybe in like 6 months.
Yeah.
We'll see it.
We talked with you before about the wonderful film that you directed and starred in and filmed right here in Maine, Black Rock. Any more directing work in your future? Because that was so good.
Yeah, I'm putting it together as we speak, and hopefully we'll be shooting it in the fall is the plan. But it's slightly genre-y, but not nearly as genre-y as Black Rock. It's more in the freebie realm of like an emotional character-driven movie, but it's weird and dark and eerie and fun.
I like the sound of that a lot. Have you seen Lake Bell's new series?
I have. Isn't she fantastic?
She is. Wonderful.
What a breath of fresh air that is.
It's such an interesting time in television and in film now because in some ways there are more opportunities, there are more platforms to get work out there. But does that also mean that when you're trying to put something together, whether it's a film or a television series, that it can be easy for people to sort of get lost with so much content available?
Absolutely. I think it's really the most difficult now for the executives. On the executive side, people are a little bit scared to take major chances. They want sure things, and they want the next Game of Thrones, and they want these very big, epic, movie star-driven things to draw audiences to their platforms, whether it be a network or a streaming service. I think, you know, in the years leading up to this, in like the 5 years leading up to this, Netflix and Amazon, it was like the Wild Wild West, and they were putting together this amazing programming that could be very small and independent and very different than what you saw on network television. And now I think they are even a little bit hesitant to do that because there is such a glut of stuff out there. And so everyone is a little gun shy. Everyone's a little not sure what is going to work. And if it's going to work now, it really, really, really has to work in order to rise above all of the rest. It's a real tricky time. And I'm like, we're in like that time of the year right now, like this very sickening time in Los Angeles, which is when network shows are getting picked up and canceled. So I just like, I have nothing on the chopping block right now, and I'm still nauseous when I open my phone because shows are getting canceled when they shouldn't be, and shows are getting picked up that maybe shouldn't. It's a real, it's a tenuous time, I think, for television, but there's so much good TV that hopefully we will sort of find a balance and some stable ground, and people can see, networks can see, and streaming services can see that it really, truly, in the end, will be quality. I think I'm being very idealistic when I say that, but hopefully it will be the quality that really rises to the top.
I hope you're right. Absolutely. Will you and Mark get some time in Maine this summer?
We are not going to make it all the way to Maine, but we'll make it to Maine in the fall, which is my favorite time to be there anyway.
Oh, pretty good. Best time of year. It's beautiful. Well, we wish you luck with everything you've got going. Can't wait to see your next appearance on a screen. Hope you have a wonderful summer. Get through this crazy
thanks.
Time out in L.A. And as always, thank you so much for spending some time with us, Katie.
Thanks so much for being such great supporters of us, always. I appreciate it.
That's Katie Asselton here on The Best of Downtown. When we come back, we'll talk with William Sanderson. Tremendous career as a character actor and a tremendous new memoir that looks back at all of it. Next on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since 2005, Pineland Farms Dairy has been making the finest cheese in Maine. Our cheddar, Monterey Jack, Pepper Jack, Baby Swiss, feta, and cheese curds are all made with natural milk from Maine. Find Pineland Farms cheese at Hannaford supermarkets, Shaw's, Whole Foods, and other great shops throughout Maine and New England. Visit online at pinelandfarmsdairy.com. Maine cows, Maine milk, Maine cheese, Pineland Farms.
Don't feel like making dinner tonight? Don't worry, Angelo's Pizzeria's got you covered. With locations in Bangor and Hamden, Angelo's is never too far from where you are. Pizza made from the finest ingredients and fresh dough, sandwiches, and subs. Calzones, pasta, chicken, burgers, salads, and more. You can find something for everyone in the family at Angelo's. Give them a call at 942-5553 or stop in at 499 Hammond Street in Bangor or 102 Main Road South in Hamden. That's Angelo's Pizzeria, open daily from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater Company presents Sequins, Spandex, and the Music of ABBA. The sunny and funny, enchanting tale of love, laughter, and friendship. Mamma Mia! At Bangor's Historic Opera House, June 13th through July 14th. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org. Walk in. Dance out.
You look like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil and
disguise. Back on the Best of Downtown Memorial Day weekend, our next guest grew up in Memphis and has got some great stories about his various run-ins with Elvis through the years. Most of all, his new book, Yes, I'm That Guy, details William Sanderson's more than four decades in the television and film industry, memorable roles in movies like Blade Runner, of course, on Newhart as the speaking part of the trio of Larry, Daryl, and Daryl. His recent work on shows like Deadwood and True Blood, and the upcoming Deadwood movie as well. Always have a wonderful time when Bill Sanderson joins us, especially this time around, talking about his brand new book. Bill, thanks for coming back with us.
Thank you very much.
Love this book so much. I told Sharon, I picked it up and I just read the whole thing at once. I couldn't put it down. It was such a tremendous read.
Well, I don't know what to say except I'm surprised because I'm always looking at the worst scenario. But I'm hopeful and I'm grateful. Thanks again.
Well, we loved it. And we've asked you this before when you were talking with us about the book and your reasons for it. Part of this is, as you point out, to have a legacy of sorts, to make sure that even though your work in television and film will be out there for a long time, well, when you put it in a book, it's there forever, but also to maybe correct any perceptions that might be out there of you and what you're like, and to let the world know that you're an educated man, you've got a law degree, you know your stuff.
Well, yes, and but I don't want to leave out vanity. I keep thinking as I'm asked questions, why'd you write it? But I hope maybe to change some opinions. Someone said, look at the roles he played. As I may have said to you before, I played a lot of idiot types, but I don't think that that's a sum total. So thank you.
Well, let's talk about your early years growing up in what was clearly a challenging situation. Your mother sounds like an absolutely incredible, strong woman.
Yeah, she was, and did everything for my brother and me, and kind of put her life, her own dreams on hold for the family. But I want to be careful here that I did all right, and that's largely because of her, you know. But the father did a lot of disciplining and telling me, trying to make me do the right thing. He just, I didn't quite, had a little hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. But I love this book I read about Santana, and he said, don't cry at your own movie. I ended up pretty good.
You sure did. Well, you found some trouble in those early years in junior high, and along the way, but you also show an amazing tendency in your life to get out of trouble when things perhaps could have gone a lot worse for you.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Second chances, second opportunities, and I just read something about that the creator of Deadwood said about second chances. So it made me feel good. It came out in the New Yorker, an article, and he has dementia now, so but that made me feel good when somebody intelligent says the same thing. But the second, you know, the juvenile offense, I didn't think that would last, but when I went in the Army, they had to give me a waiver, so I thought, man, everybody's going in the service, it's a six-year obligation. So, but I'm just rambling on and instead of talking coherently, but I did get a lot of second chances, but I acted like an adolescent even when I got out to Hollywood. But part of that was getting that 15 minutes Warhol talks about fame, and you suddenly people like you better for some reason, and I fell for it.
We're talking with William Sanderson here on Downtown. You've chatted with us a little bit about the influence of Elvis growing up in Memphis when you did. There are some incredible Elvis stories in the book, from seeing him in the middle of Bob Neal's record store. Could you share a little bit of the story? And we still want people to go read the book, but a little bit of what happened. You actually visited Graceland with Elvis there with one of the guys who owned Lansky's clothing store, where Elvis got all his duds.
Yeah, A few people have called, and thank goodness I didn't tell them the stories. I said, well, I'm not going to give them that story. I'll put it down. But I don't know how well I tell that one. I don't want to give it away completely. There's, which one you think, Bob Neal Record Shop or the when he was playing the piano in his house?
Well, that was a pretty good. Actually, I think my favorite, though, is Elvis and you, because you just sort of inserted yourself into the Memphis Mafia, knowing where he was going to be. It was at the amusement park when you ran into him a little too hard doing the bumper cars?
Oh, yeah. I had a friend who was a friend of the Blackwood Brothers, a gospel group, and the Blackwood Brothers always knew what night Elvis was going to the Memphian and rent the theater or amusement park. He would go out at midnight. So I did slide in a side gate, and it was a crowd of mostly his friends and stuff. So Elvis had his buddies on one team, and I jumped in. They call them Dodger bumper cars, and like an idiot, I was hitting head-on with the car, and he said, man, I told you not to do that. And, boy, I just apologized like crazy. I'm sorry. And he almost immediately, he said, oh, it's okay. I just hate to keep replacing the motors. But if he was anything, he was always pleasant to the fans. And I call myself a stalker later, or I should say groupie now. But I drive down to Mississippi. Most people didn't know he had a ranch down there. I might stand outside the gate just waiting for him to drive out. Priscilla, I was a little bit obsessed, but got to see him from grade school and junior high and high school. So not when he became older, the caricature, I call it, of Elvis. But he was a very generous person and sparked a dream, as Keith Richards said, he sparked a dream.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, you talk about the concerts that you got to see. You know, so growing up in the same city, you saw Elvis three times before you were 13 years old?
Well, the first time I was 11 or 12, probably sixth grade, and that was an outdoor concert. We call it like a Hollywood Bowl, only this one would hold 5,000. So he played there, and I started around dusk, and Sam Phillips was in the audience, and I was on the front row, I believe. But then the next year was when I, hanging around Lansky Brothers on Beale Street where he bought his clothes, and Mr. Lansky, am I making it too long?
No, not at all.
Mr. Lansky knew that his son was in my mother's third grade class. So I guess that gave me a little. So I'm 13, I think, in seventh grade. He said, you want to ride out to the house? And I have to deliver some clothes. So I did. And Sharon said, don't tell the whole story. But I did get to go in the house. And I'll just say he was playing the piano. And in the book, I say the songs that I can remember. And his buddies were around the piano, but I thought it was a dream. I'm sitting there, a big white piano with gold trim and white television. And within the next, I'll just cut the story off, but his mother came down to listen to it, leaning against the doorway. But within a couple of years or so, he was the highest paid entertainer in the world. And I thought, God, you know, so.
And he was
a lot of fun. Then got to play after he got out of the Army, and I got older, and he got to play a little football with him on
right.
Until it got so popular that I couldn't even grab a jersey.
Well, and he was an influence on you, as he was millions of young people in terms of fashion. Have you ever felt better about yourself than you did when you were sporting that turquoise rock and roll shirt?
Oh, thank you for remembering that. I think my mother bought that. But rock and roll, we kind of claim that it started there. A lot of people would argue with you. But and the great black artists, and I got to see them live. And, you know, there was Jerry Lee Lewis, whom I saw, Johnny Cash. I didn't see Roy Orbison. He recorded there. No, I like that shirt, and I still like turquoise, but I was probably wanting to be a rock and roller.
William Sanderson's book is called Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. You went to law school, wandered into a theater class, and that was a life-changing event for you in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure was gradual, but it was fun. And I always wanted to get over shyness, whatever I ended up doing. So I think I discovered at a local theater with a good teacher, you can still be shy and act. So you just put the right stuff in your head. It took a while. You know, the apprenticeship in New York was probably the biggest help with stage plays and things. But law school, yeah. I should tell them I never took the bar exam, but made some good friends, and to this day, and I don't regret going to law school. I read once about Sinatra, whom I love to hear sing, but he said he got self-conscious when he went into groups of intelligent, educated, or you know what I'm saying, and I don't.
Right, right. Now you
know,
do that.
I would be for some other reason, but not because they dazzled me with their intellect.
Well, when you moved to New York, that was an interesting experience. You were tending bar, you were acting, and you were getting in some more trouble. And as you point out, you're so honest and open about it throughout the course of the book. You prove time and again that Bill Sanderson and alcohol makes for a very combustible mix.
Yeah, and I was fearful that everybody thinks they were wild or outlaw type, but bartending, you're pretty close to it, and it's free, but I had a real good probation officer, and that helped, but I had some close calls by being arrested and doing dumb things, but those second chances, That article about, I better be quiet about that. I don't know how much to talk about it, but to try to get somebody to read the book, the arrests were in double figures. But the biggest one, the scariest one, was out in California, was a shakedown. And actually,
right,
more than one shakedown. I only can imagine what these stars do and happened. And I said to my buddy one time, well, the Elvis didn't let that happen. And my buddy said, he paid them off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, but you know, you just become a target sometimes. But you know, it was much my fault as anybody else's, I guess. But how many, the second chance to get out? You know, I was fired a lot of times, and I've realized it goes on in business, and then rehired by the same people.
Right.
It's weird.
Well, you made your way west into the movies, getting some help from Joseph Wamba along the way, and then a really wonderful experience, it sounds like, working on Coal Miner's Daughter with Sissy Spacek, and a guy that you came to work with quite a bit, and an equally volatile character in the book, Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, thank you for mentioning both of them. I survived six projects with Tommy, and they asked me to do a seventh, but I couldn't get out of another job. But Sissy Spacek, a class act, I started to get a little success, you know, and I would see how she handled a compliment. Somebody would say something nice to her, she'd just say thank you. And it's not that easy. I've seen Bob Newhart talk about it. He's such a friend of Carson's, and he said, somebody says you did a good job, and you say, oh, no, I dropped the ball, or I didn't do that well. Newhart says you get two compliments, because they come back and say, oh, yeah, you were really good, instead of just saying thank you. Did any of that make any sense?
It sure did, yeah. I was very pleased because he's one of my favorite actors of all time, and you're the second person that will tell us good things about James Garner here on the show. The other was Julie Andrews, who absolutely loved working with him back in the Americanization of Emily, and he is, as you put it in the book, a real mensch.
Oh. Couldn't say enough, you know. And another sad thing, they rebooted or they did one season of Maverick.
Mm.
And so I tell in the book about how nice he was to explain what you have to do when they reverse the camera angle. Mm. And he said that we're going to use you when they bring the show back next season. And they didn't bring it back because of some argument between Mr. Garner and the producer, but he was also nice to my son at a Raiders football game. But I think he's known as a classic guy himself.
Also, now we've talked with you before about the New Heart experience, but I thought it was interesting that nobody is one-dimensional, and Bob Newhart certainly was a guy who cared about the people he worked with, but you also point out in the book he was pretty protective of what he had, wanted to make sure that people didn't cash in on those roles that he felt his show provided.
Well, that and Levy's show, I've done a lot of thinking. If you give somebody a job, and first chance they get, they want to go somewhere else. He figures that he gave you the shot. So his manager was the head of MTM, so he had great power, like a Jackie Gleason or somebody. But I learned a lot from him, and I liked the way he treated the crew. They had done his old show on the same stage, so he knew them by first name. He still works. Sometimes I think he still does shows. He's 89. I was lucky to be a small part of that show with my brother Daryl, Tony Pappenfuss, and John Volstead.
I also, you made both Carrie and I really want to see a movie that you did not that long ago. That sounds like a wonderful experience. Can you share a little bit about Stanley's gig?
Oh, my goodness. The script was wonderful, and it's about a guy who dreams of, he's a ukulele player, and he dreams of playing on a cruise ship. In real life, it's based on a true story. In real life, the guy was drunk, and he found salvation by working in a old folks' home. But we had a first-time director, and they chose to do it with a low budget. Someone said, the director was offered a lot of money to sell it to Universal, and they said they'd give it to Robin Williams. But it didn't do much. They didn't promote it. I think Stars played it. It had Marla Gibbs, who's a wonderful singer. And an actor named Stephen Tobolowsky. Has he been on your show?
He's a great friend of our show. He's been on many times.
Yes, he was on there and Faye Dunaway, which when right. I got this independent film, I thought, that's a good name to drop. But I tell a story in there about her. I hope people will read the book. She's a diva, and I keep my mouth shut around her.
But very professional as well, as you point out. Read the book to get the story. Let's talk about Eustace Bailey Farnum. You say it's the high point of your acting career. What did that opportunity to be in Deadwood do for you?
Well, besides buy a second home back here, modest home in Pennsylvania, and, it was just great writing. David Milch, which I keep mentioning. I'm so sorry that he's ill now. But everybody on the show was lucky enough to go on to another show. And I know it's not everybody's thing because it has some rough language. But it was based on my character, the mayor, based on a real character. But he decided to make him David decided to make my character something of a buffoon, but that's all right. That's all right. I think it's why I got the next job on True Blood, because had I not done Deadwood, I might not have gotten that one. But I don't know how to describe it without sounding like I'm bragging. I got to be in every show, and there's only two of us for some reason, Ian McShane and I. And that's kind of lucky for a character actor.
Well, and to
I
deliver
felt like a walk on, I felt like a walk on.
And to deliver some incredible monologues.
Yeah, he seemed to give everybody one, and I put some of them down in the book. I hope it's legal that he gave, and that were in some articles. But his incredible. I've never read anything somebody said, so I don't want to take too much of your time.
You can never take too much of our time, Bill.
Well, I'll try to make it quickly. In this article I just read, the author's talking about Milch's dementia, and he said, well, do you go to a place like Deadwood? Would that help you clear your head? And David said, I think that is the chief blessing of art, the opportunity to organize one's behavior around a different reality. Then he said, it's a second chance. You pray to be equal to it.
Mm.
I talked about second chances.
Yeah.
Now, one of the points you make, and I found it a really interesting point in your book, that the character of E.B. Farnham is in some ways reflects some of what Milch thinks of himself. And so you became almost an extension of him within the show.
Well, they've said, if I heard what I was saying, I think people would say, that guy takes himself very seriously. I think sometimes authors, their alter egos, those characters in the novels and books. But David is part Swearingen, the tough guy, the vulgar mouth, and he's tender at times when he writes the parts for the women. And he's funny. And my character just kept surprising me, and that's. But I do think a lot of it is David, yeah. And some of his family or people.
When you talk about second chances, have you had a bigger second chance than your wife Sharon?
Oh no. I bet I talked about it before. I couldn't even organize my little schedule right now without her coordinating the interviews and things, and I couldn't get on a plane. They invited us to Deadwood premiere, and I wasn't able to go because a lot's happening back here. But it's always more work for her, and I looked up a word, uxorious. Did I say that before? Is too much?
No.
Credit for one's spouse or wife, but maybe I could lighten it by saying she's very smart. I hope she doesn't leave me.
Well, the book is in many ways also a wonderful love story about you two, and I love the stories. It's been an amazing ride for you through the years, but to me what made the book so powerful, and I told Sharon, I teared up at the end of it because it seems like as you settle in here to what you call your semi-retirement, we hope it's no more than that, but it seems like you've been able to find some peace of mind. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, but what you say scared me. I don't have the stamina and energy. Did you just have Paul Dooley on your show?
We did, yes.
My God, do you think that doesn't make me humble? Talk about a character actor. And I know one time I said, who got the job? I auditioned for something. They said, oh, a guy named Paul Dooley. And I said, well, you don't mind losing a job to someone like that. I'd sure do segue, don't I? But I really appreciate what you're saying. I'm sure I'm stealing somebody's words, but if they read it, boy. You say compliments, and that throws people. Find out who the real hero is.
Well, we
by
just
reading the pages.
We love the book. I couldn't get enough of it. It's one of those books I know I'm going to reread again. And I know you don't like getting those compliments, Bill, but it's an inspirational book. It's a powerful book, and man, I hope more and more people read it. Yes, I'm that guy. The rough and tumble life of a character actor.
Thank you. Rough and tumble life of character. I live for compliments, but I try to hide it.
Well,
there's a Jackie Gleason said self-deception thrives in the compost of flattery. And I trust you. I love doing the show. But out in Hollywood, that's how they motivate you, you know. And so, but you made my day.
Well, you made ours by being with us. We love the book. We wish you great success with this. About 10, 11 days until the Deadwood movie comes out. We look forward to seeing that as well. And we wish you and Sharon nothing but health and happiness, and hope to have you back again before too long.
Oh, it's an honor to be on your show, and I'm full of the S word sometimes. Take care, okay?
Thank you, Bill. That's actor Bill Sanderson here on The Best of Downtown, and he is rapidly rising near the top of our list of favorite people to talk to on the program.
Yeah, it's always fun to have him on the show, and once he opens up a little bit, I think each time he opens up a little bit more, he knows that we're interested in hearing what he has to say, not just having a celebrity on.
Right, exactly. Well, check out his book. It really is terrific. Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor by William Sanderson. Our thanks to Bill, Katie Azleton, and Adam Savage. And thanks to you for making us a part of your holiday weekend. Hope the rest of it goes well for you. Join us tomorrow for a very special Downtown. It's the almost half year in review, or the best of 2019 so far. We may not even decide by tomorrow, but some great conversations from the first 5 months of the year, including Richard Schiff of The West Wing and The Good Doctor, actor Steve Guttenberg, Loretta Swit of MASH, singer-songwriter Grammy Award winner Roseanne Cash, and author and humorist Tom Baudet of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That's all on Monday's Memorial Day edition of Downtown. We'll see you at 4 o'clock tomorrow right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna